Well, good evening and welcome. Before we start, I'm going to ask if people who have sat anywhere beyond 15 metres of the front can come to the front, because we're very scattered and we are hoping to collect questions through the night, and it will make it a lot less legwork for people who are wanting to do that. If we all sit a little bit closer, it might also make it a more friendly gathering. This is a chance to get up close and personal with our politicians or aspiring politicians, so please take the opportunity to come forward. Even though it is church, and I know there's an unwritten rule in church that the first 8 rows are free. While you do that, let me introduce myself. I'm David Bush, and while I'm designated on your program as having a particular role in the ABC, I stand here entirely as Joe Citizen, and very happy to be invited to facilitate and moderate this evening in an entirely neutral, non-partisan and non-ABC way. I'll even try not to be Tony Jones and interrupt our panellists too much. Certainly wouldn't aspire to be the thinking woman sex symbol, that's for sure. May I encourage you to turn your mobile phones at least onto silent. We're not going to be flying in such hot air that the leaving it on will interrupt our flying instruments, but at least not having them ring loudly will be a help for us. Tonight, if you need to use the facilities, you can exit through those glass doors at the side or through the back and come around, and they are behind us here. There's a passageway behind us if you need to do that. Our hope is to, our expectation, intention is to finish here around 9 o'clock. So it won't be a late night. You can dash home and watch the end of Gruen Nation and the beginning of The Chaser, and then stay up for Late Line and all the rest of it. What a great night ahead. But the highlight of the night will be here. Of course, you'll have had your dose of political insight before you even get to Late Line. Before we begin, I'm going to invite Ravina Waldron from Catholic Murray Ministry to come and do Welcome to Country. Thanks, Ravina.
Good evening. Let us acknowledge the traditional custodians who have walked and cared for this land for thousands of years, and their descendants who maintain these spiritual connections and traditions. Let us also observe 1 minute silence to reflect on the millions of footprints that have walked and travelled the dreaming pathways, and our own loved ones who have gone before us. So if we could just stand and take a moment's silence, please, to remember our elders, those who care and maintain the wisdom and traditions of our culture. Thank you.
Thank you, Ravina. This evening is a joint exercise of the Catholic, Anglican and Uniting Churches, their respective social justice and peace agencies, and for the Uniting Church, the Moreton Rivers Presbytery. And I'm going to ask Andrew Johnson from the Moreton Rivers Presbytery, who's also one of the panellists who'll be asking questions of our politicians, to come and open the proceedings with prayer.
Gracious God, be present with us tonight as we seek to discern your will for our nation. Be with each of our candidates and be with their families. We know that elections can be trying and difficult times for candidates, and we would pray your peace and love surround them. Be with our nation and each of the communities as they listen and try and discern what is the peaceful, justice, loving and right way for our country. And be with each one of us tonight. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Now, the churches who put this on have issued a statement about faith at the ballot box, which is in your program, but was felt to be important to actually have that in the front of mind as we consider the issues that are for discussion tonight. And so I'm going to ask Shana Tucker from the Catholic Social Justice and Peace Commission to come forward and read that statement to us as a guiding set of principles and ideas from the faith communities about the political debates for this election. Thank you, Shana.
Many faith-based organisations have put out material in the lead-up to this year's election, including the Catholic Bishops and the Uniting Church National Assembly. We have drawn on that material in preparing this paper for this evening. We urge Christians to take their democratic freedom seriously and become involved in the political process. For some, this will also mean making informed ethical choices at the ballot box. For others, it might mean standing for election. We acknowledge and encourage the many Christians who are already engaged in political life at various levels. Relationship with God takes us deeper into the fullness of life, all the wonder and joy, and all the harshness and sadness. Christianity is a faith of engagement. Knowing the love of God leads us to loving others. The way we are called to express this love is found in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Jesus is the love of God breaking into the world. Those who were marginalised by others were accepted and loved by Jesus. Jesus spoke of God's bias for the poor and the weak. He challenged the systems and structures of oppression in his society. As Christians, we are called to challenge systems and structures in our society that do not address the problems of injustice, poverty, and oppression. As we experience the fullness of life that relationship with God in Christ offers us, we learn that the Christian life demands of us more than a little courage. We are not called to merely believe. We are not called to put limits on God's love. Christians cannot fear the stranger and remain indifferent to suffering. We cannot live faithfully unless we open the doors of our hearts and the doors of our churches. Many Christian traditions hold that the common good is underpinned by the promotion and protection of human dignity. Implicit in seeking the common good is a desire to serve the poor, the marginalised, the sick and the forgotten in our society. An economy for life, then, would be marked by regard for the common good. Economic systems which are based on values such as individualism, competition and greed deny human flourishing because the fullness of our humanity is not found in wealth but in relationship with each other and the world around us. Clearly, an economy which sees conservation of the natural environment or protection of the poorest as secondary or peripheral question will come under challenge from this faith perspective. Wealth creation is never an end in itself. We look towards fashioning an economy which supports a rich life, not necessarily a life of riches. The values at the heart of our faith have led Christian churches to highlight their concerns and priorities about a range of issues, including the ethical issues associated with public policy and a range of life issues, including abortion, euthanasia, stem cell research, capital punishment, and other issues concerning the dignity of human life. The impact of changing taxation, welfare, and industrial relations arrangements on people, families, and communities. Just policies, which acknowledge the culture, unique history, and disadvantage of Indigenous Australians and promote genuine partnerships. Ensuring all people have access to healthcare, education and housing as a basic human right, particularly those on the margins of society, including those with mental illness. Dignity and choice for older Australians when making decisions about accommodation and care. care of God's creation for a sustainable future for the earth and future generations, in particular management of water resources, effective response to climate change and the conservation of our unique natural heritage, respecting the dignity of people who flee persecution and violence in other lands, and encouraging our nation to practice the biblical tradition of welcoming the stranger. Responsibility as a global citizen to be generous in seeking to eradicate extreme poverty and cooperatively work to promote peace. Fundamental to the process of government in a free and democratic nation are transparency, respect for human rights, honesty and community engagement. As Christian communities, we see it as important to play a role in our political process, and the opportunity to engage with our political leaders at this election is vital. We appreciate the opportunity we have this evening. Building an economy for life requires the gift of hope that we have been offered by God. This is the hope that reminds us that the world can be different. Out of this hope, we can speak and serve with confidence as we strive to be faithful to the heart of the Christian gospel, seeking the promise of a world where all creation flourishes and all people live in dignity and hope.
Thank you, Shana. It's a very comprehensive statement. I'm sure you'd agree. Lots to think about. Let me introduce our panellists and then the process that we will undergo tonight and get the discussion underway. It is a great privilege to have our four candidates or politicians here tonight, and we're very grateful that each of you have prioritised this among everything else that you might have done, including even possibly a night off. It's very good that you've done this. And it looks like, I guess, today that Tony's not going to debate Julia a second time. So we've got our own little leaders' debate happening here. And it's exactly, I'm told, the halfway point of the campaign. So we're at the fulcrum. And so it's really good that you're able to be part of this process. I'm going to introduce our four people, and then I'll invite you to applaud them all together rather than one at a time. So starting over there on your far left, we have Senator Claire Moore, far left geographically, not politically. Claire, born in Toowoomba, university courses before working public Commonwealth Public Service, experience in the Commonwealth Public Service Union, a position that you held through the 90s until elected in 2001. And Claire took her position as a senator in July 2002 for Queensland. Particular passions in Indigenous issues and native title, friends of the ABC, Australian Republican Movement, Overseas Aid, Queensland Council of Unions, women's history, and even in your interests, Claire, detective fiction, Paul Keating, art galleries and cricket. There you go. Okay. And in her political career, Claire's been involved in a number of political and parliamentary committees, including being chair of the Parliamentary Group on Population Development, which is one that's becoming relevant to this particular campaign. Claire is not up for re-election this year, but of course on the hustings supporting the Labor Party. Next to Claire is Libby Connors. Libby is a candidate for the Greens for the Senate in Queensland, and Libby's been involved in human rights and environmental and community politics for many years. Senior lecturer in history at the University of Southern Queensland, where she teaches Australian history. Libby's written several publications on Queensland history and co-authored three books on aspects of Australian history and writing a fourth on early Queensland. Have I got those all correct there, Libby? Good on you. Libby is married to someone else we'd know very well, Drew Hutton, and the two were foundational in helping to form the Queensland and Australian Greens. Next to Libby is Senator Brett Mason. Brett was born in Canberra and holds a Bachelor of Arts degree and a Bachelor of Laws with honours. He's got a Master's in Philosophy from Cambridge and a PhD from Griffith. So, great mind in there. He worked as a barrister and lecturer in criminology at QUT before being elected to the Senate in 1998 for the Liberal Party. In the final year of the Howard government, he was Parliamentary Secretary for Health and Ageing, and now in opposition, he's a Shadow Parliamentary Secretary for Education and School Curriculum Standards and Shadow Parliamentary Secretary for Innovation, Industry, Science and Research. Not sure about Brett's personal interests, but he's the author of Privacy Without Principle, The Use and Abuse of Privacy in Australian Law and Public Policy. So if you want to talk about the Do Not Call Register or maybe even the internet filter, I'm not sure, probably not, see Brett. Brett is up for re-election this year. And finally, next to Brett is Wendy Francis, and Wendy is the lead Senate candidate for Family First. And Wendy's a high-profile businesswoman with a background in management, marketing and community activism. She's a board member and director of Samaritan's Purse Australia and the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association and a committee member of the Family Association of Queensland. She's executive producer also of the Lord Mayor's Christmas Carols in Brisbane. Be warming up shortly, I would expect, Wendy. Married to Peter Francis, who's the senior pastor at the City Tabernacle Baptist Church here in Brisbane. And somewhere in the web it said that at only 48 she's a grandmother of 8 and a mother of 3, which seemed to be an example of putting family first. I'm not really sure what that means. Okay, credentials in family concerns right up there at the front. Wendy has achieved the rare distinction of having her political ad rejected by an outdoor billboard company and had her own leaders' debate with Australian Sex Party on Sunrise Television a few days ago. I don't know whether you saw that. It was certainly a much feistier affair than what Julia and Tony had managed to deliver last weekend. Would you please welcome our four political candidates? We've got a bit like the leaders' debate, isn't it? We've got a little panel here of people who are going to be the interlocutors, the questioners, to open up the issues for our politicians. And I'll introduce those to you, then we can applaud them all together. We have next to Wendy Francis on the far side here is the very Reverend Dr. Peter Catt, who is the Anglican Dean of Brisbane. We have Andrew Johnson, who holds a number of positions. He has been social justice advocate for the Uniting Church Synod, and since that position kind of evaporated due to some funding issues, Andrew has pursued his interests in social justice and environmental issues for the Uniting Church through the Moreton Rivers Presbytery and attached to the West End Mission, the Southside Inner City Parish of the Uniting Church. Welcome, Andrew. And Camilla Cowley, who is well known as an activist of many years standing on Indigenous issues and refugees, been very strongly involved in those issues and involved in the Catholic Church social justice work. Would you please welcome Peter, Andrew and Camilla. Now, in the preparation for tonight, they worked out what are some of the key issues that we want to unpack in this, and you'd be aware, maybe, that this is one of two of these forums. The next one is next Monday night at St Paul's Uniting Church, Stafford, where we'll have two of the same candidates here and two others. And the delineation of how we would divide the subjects for the two nights is that tonight, I suppose in a very broad sense, you might say we're talking about social policy, although there are strong economic implications in that, and social and international policy. And then next Monday night, it's more the hard economic stuff to do with tax and poverty and population and housing and that sort of stuff. Tonight, the focus of the questions that have been proposed by the panel are in the areas of mental health, climate change, border protection and asylum seekers and Indigenous issues. So you are welcome yourselves to participate in this by using the blank sheet of paper that you received in your program. That is a piece of paper for you to be able to write questions. And you can start writing them now, or you can write them through the discussion that's happening or through the evening. And if I invite Shana to stand again and Sean Cleary, they're standing over here at the moment, I might suggest that one of them go onto that side. As you write your question, tear it in half if you want to write more than one, would you just, you know, without being too obtrusive about it, hold it up at shoulder height, and that will be a signal that they will come and collect it from you. And then after we've had the initial batch of questions with the panel, we'll go to questions from you. Our desire is not really to open up to conversation at the floor, but to actually direct the questions in writing that have come from you to the panel in order to help make it focused and the best use of time. So that is your way of actually putting your questions to the candidates. Okay, so we're going to start with the question of mental health. And Peter Catt, you've got the first question, so I'd invite you to direct that question and to ask it, please.
Yeah, thank you, David, and thank you to the candidates. My first question is for Senator Mason, if I may. Senator Mason, you'll be aware that mental health has been labelled as a health priority for 18 years. And both major parties have announced single initiatives during this campaign which health experts have acknowledged are good but also label as inadequate. So my question is about strategy, and that's the key word, strategy. What strategy do you have for achieving the objective of bringing the provision of mental health services to the level of 85%, which is the level, say, that applies to diabetes at present? So what's the strategy for bringing the provision of mental health services to 85% plus by 2020? Thank you.
A bit of thanks. Ladies and gentlemen, pick up one of the microphones. I have such a loud voice. As Senator Moore would know, I really need a microphone. But, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for having me here this evening.
You're feeding back there.
What's that?
It's a bit feedback there.
Is that?
What I might suggest you do is pick it up and hold it.
Hold it.
Is that okay? Then share with Wendy. Can Libby and Claire share? Good on you.
Do I need this microphone?
Yes.
I do?
Yes.
All right. So thank you for having me here this evening. You mentioned, David, that I was briefly a parliamentary secretary right at the end of the Howard government, the last 6 months actually. And the job actually was as parliamentary secretary for health under Tony Abbott. And my principal responsibility was mental health. And you are right, there has been neglect, I think it's fair to say, for many years in the region of mental health. What the Howard government did was spend, what, about nearly $1.9 billion on mental health. And primarily what we did was spend a lot of that money setting up Headspace. There was Medicare rebates for psychologists and better education for general practitioners. That was sort of the principal elements of what the $1.9 billion that John Howard put into that scheme. And it was by far the greatest expenditure on mental health in our federal history. What Tony Abbott announced the other day was, I've got the papers right here, I think it's $1.5 billion. And $1.5 billion he's announced that he'll be spending, and that's to provide 800 new acute and subacute mental health beds, specifically to support the early psychosis intervention centres. And the reason for that is this, that about one in five Australians suffers a mental health episode every year. Peter, that's right, isn't it? About one in five, and primarily among young people. And all the evidence is that if we attack the problem when people are young, it becomes much less expensive then than later on when it causes, you know, family breakdown, crime, homelessness, and other social issues. So it's certainly the time to do it. And that's why the large part of that $1.5 billion is for new acute and subacute mental health beds, for early intervention for young people. And then there's also money for Headspace sites, which is another innovation. Can I just add one other thing? This issue, in fact, I discussed this with Camilla outside. This issue isn't just one of government. Sure, government has an enormous responsibility, and I accept that, and we have perhaps done as well as we should have. But it's also, it's a cultural problem as well. I mean, my father, who died last year, had Lewy body dementia, all right? And he had it for something like 15 years. And it wasn't that there wasn't help available. You know what the problem was, Peter? He didn't want to go and see people about that problem. You know, he was of that generation which were quite stoic, you know, didn't believe in blokes having any assistance. So the problem is partly funding, it's education. Jeff Kennett runs the Beyond Blue, which is a great innovation, and Head Start is another great innovation for young people. But so it's partly about government, and Tony Abbott has made, I think, some great headway, but also partly it is about education and a change in culture in our community.
Thank you. Thank you. Peter's got another question on mental health, and then I'm going to, which will be directed to Claire, and then I'm going to invite the other panellists to respond before we leave the mental health issue. But the Coalition policy fact sheet, Brett, on mental health says that almost half the population will experience a mental health episode sometime in their life. The one in five, or 20% of the population aged 16 to 85, experienced an episode in the past 12 months. So it's a huge issue, and one that, as Peter rightly says, there is a an unmet demand for services. Peter, your question now to Claire, please.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Moore, thank you. As long ago as 1996, CHOGM agreed that the laws pertaining to mental health need to be harmonised across the various jurisdictions to ensure good patient management and mental health outcomes. This priority has more recently been identified as a key area by the Health and Hospital Reform Commission report and by the Law Reform Commission report. Can you account for why this important human rights issue has not been addressed, and can you tell us when it's intended that the laws will be harmonised, please?
As recently as the two Senate inquiries on mental health that I was fortunate enough to be on, this was also a recommendation from that. And before I continue, can I just share in the acknowledgement of the traditional owners, Rubina, and thank you for your welcome and acknowledgement, and pay my respects to all elders of all cultures. I think that's an important element. But in terms of this question, it is part of the COAG agenda, and certainly it's a COAG issue. There has been progress, but we haven't achieved as a COAG, which is a cooperative arrangement between federal and state government in harmonising the laws. And there's probably a whole lot of reasons for that in terms of state thoughts about what should go first. There's a lot of issues about the law and also the way that the law and the health systems interact. But it's a core part of our strategy, and I'll take the chance to address the strategy question in the same response, to ensure that the COAG system is active and effective. Because whilst we believe that the medical aspects of mental health, which are real and must be considered, that will be addressed in the health reform process that our government has actually introduced. And in that way, we're ensuring that the immediate health aspects, and that includes the hospital aspects, will be a responsibility of the federal government. And that's worked out, and I won't go through the numbers, it's all on the internet about hospital beds and so on, responsibility for servicing and so on. However, it's not just a medical issue. And as Brett quite rightly said, it crosses all areas in terms of the need for communities, the need for families, the need for individuals to feel as though they have safety and respect in their issues of health. And we believe that the community engagement is also a strategy that needs to be enforced. And our strategy in the area of mental health is engagement with community and engagement with people. And through that, in that course, we work with the Mental Health Council of Australia, with consumers groups, with the Ministerial Advisory Group, which is made up of a cross-section of people who are interested in the area to ensure that government can develop effectively and cooperatively a responsive policy. And that's been the role that we've played. So we certainly have not said that we have actually solved the issues of mental health. Every year of our government, funding has increased, and you can trace that and you can see what's happening. It is not enough, and we've accepted that. We need to continue working in this area, but most importantly, we can't label the issue of mental health and make it surely only a medical issue, because that creates a division in the community. So if you look at our program, what we have released is a strategy around suicide, and looking at engagement with young people in particular about that, also with men's groups. Again, not imposing from on high, but working effectively with those people who have the knowledge and the need. And that's our strategy. I can't say that we will harmonise the laws in the next period of time. It is clearly on the COAG agenda and has been. In terms of where we're going, you can trace the progress that has happened. There has been some progress in terms of looking at the way the law operates with people cross-border, because people insist on having their issues in the state in which they are not born. I just cannot believe that. So in terms of the way our system tends to operate, your residential address and where you're born seems to be the issue that you're identified with, whereas indeed you can have an issue of severe mental health crisis when you're away from the home that you've actually been treated in the past, and that's one of the core aspects of that difference between states. There already have been extremely positive cooperative arrangement between states, which to our shame were not there in the past. That if you were a New South Wales citizen in Queensland, there were difficulties in you getting the help you needed, because the idea was to ship you back to New South Wales because that's the area from which you came. That is no longer occurring. what has to happen is that there is that interchange between the states. So, Peter, in terms of your specific question, that's a clear aspect where there has been progress. But for me, probably the most exciting aspect is that when we had this forum 3 years ago, the words mental health were not on the agenda. So in terms of actually having people prioritise that in the community, that means there has been progress. We have not spent enough money on it. We need to spend more, but there are more announcements coming. But that can't be singularly a federal government issue.
You must be disappointed that John Mendoza and Petra McGorry have just been so disappointed and angry at Labor's response to the work they did to give the government a whole-of-government plan for mental health.
Can I respond to that, Peter, in terms of a comment?
Yes, and then I'm going to invite Libby and Wendy to...
John Mendoza and Pat McGorry are doing their job. And they're both personal friends, for what it's worth. But in terms of process, at the moment we have Pat, in his moment of real influence as Australian of the Year, doing his job, which is keeping the focus on mental health. I believe that some of the comments they've made have been driven by their passion and have not really understood what our funding program has been, and we've had that discussion. So we have not actually announced a full mental health program, and we've acknowledged that. And that was a bit of a concern in the media when Pat and John jumped in, quite rightly, because it's their job to raise the issue, because both of them are long-term mental health advocates. We don't agree with whatever, with all the things they've said, but we do not believe that there's any limit to their right to say it, and we continue to work very closely with them. So no matter how it's portrayed in the media, the relationship between Pat McGorry, in his role as a senior advocate for mental health in this country, and John, who has left the Mental Health Advisory Council to operate more independently because he couldn't be as openly critical when he had that position. We continue, and particularly our Minister, Nicola Roxon, continues to work very closely with both of those gentlemen and numerous others. So in terms of the process, we actually have that ongoing relationship as recently as 2:30 this afternoon.
Good. A lot can happen in a few hours, but that's great. I'm going to ask Wendy Francis for Family First, the mental health strategy and priority for your party, please.
Hi, everybody. Nice to be here tonight. As I've travelled around the different communities, what I'm hearing is that they are feeling as if they are totally overlooked by the current government, but by the major parties, and particularly in this area. Some of the communities that have gone to do not have any medical centres at all. So they're small communities, but they're communities with thousands of people in them, like Allera and Killarney, not very far from Brisbane. And the rural communities have got higher suicide rates. If we're talking about extreme manifestation of mental illness, then we're talking the incredibly high suicide rates. Queensland has, for the last more than a decade, has had the highest suicide rates in Australia. And it's even higher in the rural areas. And so these people are being overlooked, and yet at the same time we're wasting so much money on tuck shops that are going to close down at the middle of next year or even at the end of this year. And some of these rural communities are saying to me, we just feel so discouraged because we're not being heard. So they're people, they're real people, and they feel as if the political game has them totally overlooked and lost. And not one of us here tonight would not have been touched by somebody close to us with a mental illness. And so we know how important it is. And in the rural communities, they are feeling totally just isolated and left alone. And so I understand that it's not just money, it's not just governments and the community, but the communities are crying out. And the government, it's not as if there's not money there. The money has been spent. Millions and millions of dollars have been spent. And particularly in the Killarney area, two of the schools that money has been spent on are set for closure at the end of this year or halfway through next year.
So, Wendy, I'm sorry, your policy then on mental health, having heard those concerns?
Minor parties, it's very difficult for minor parties to actually have a huge amount of policies. But what we can do as a minor party is bring balance to the balance of power. And when we look at the policies coming across, that's when we can have comment. I would support anything that would... What I would be wanting to do is to speak up for the people and to say, OK, that's fine, you're doing all this, but what about the people in Killarney? That's what I want to do. So I will be examining policy as it comes, and that's when I can have an impact.
Thanks, Wendy. Libby, for the Greens, mental health, please. Strategy and community engagement.
Thanks.
And funding.
Can I also just respond to both Brett and Claire? Yes. It was interesting. It was really good that Brett went first because, Brett, you stirred up my emotions and made me go outside just my prepared notes. I have a brother who suffers from mental illness and is on a disability pension. And sure, you can pour money into mental health services, but what really, really stressed him through the Howard years was the attempts to get the disability pensioners off the pension. He lived in fear that he was going to lose his pension and therefore his house. And it's a good example of, and I mean, he's not my only experience. I have a friend whose mother suffered from Alzheimer's and had to be in long-term care. And what both those very close examples said to me is that mental health depends on the family. If you don't have a family who will take care of you, then you do end up wandering the streets. And, I mean, I'm quite proud of my brother that he's in West End, and they do have an interesting network around West End where a lot of people with mental illness support one another. They're real characters. It isn't just the dollars. It isn't just a health policy. It's about a whole-of-government response. And 25 years ago, when I was backpacking in Europe along with some of my other university friends, one of the most amazing experiences I had was when I was in Sweden and staying with a family. And the mother of the household, what did she want to show me that she was most proud of about living in Sweden in the 1980s? She insisted on taking me down to their aged care facility to say, isn't this a beautiful, wonderful, state-of-the-art facility, because we really care about our old people in Sweden. And I think everybody was so excited about the election of the Rudd government because they were promised compassion. And that's why people like Pat Mendoza and Pat McGorry have made their public statements. There were these commitments about building a more compassionate society after those really tough, everybody off the dole kind of years. And it just hasn't been fulfilled. And I think that's why the social movements and why the mood of this election is so full of disillusionment and despair as both the major parties talk in the old language. I mean, I do have a Greens policy here. I can give you figures. I did want to say that Senator Rachel Sewart for the Greens chaired the Senate Committee on Suicide, and she has also stated already her great disappointment that the government has not already started work on the report, that it's only accepted some of the recommendations that came out of that Senate committee. And in terms of trying to get a national uniform policy on mental health, the Greens want to see a minister for mental health appointed, somebody who will work full-time on this issue and bring us up to scratch with the rest of the world, or at least with the OECD, where there is proper commitment for aged care and for mental health care so that these people aren't sidelined and totally at the mercy of families, because some people out there don't have families.
Thank you, Libby. We're going to move on to the next topic, but if you're exercised about what you've heard, please use your sheets to write a question which we can feed into discussion a little later. The next topic we're going to move to is climate change, and Andrew Johnson's going to be asking the questions. Thanks, Andrew.
Okay, thanks. My first question on climate change is around a carbon price, and it's directed to the Greens. The government was unsuccessful in its attempt to introduce an emissions trading scheme, Libby, and it was primarily about putting a price on carbon and a cap on carbon. And it was as a result of opposition from the Greens, Family First and the LNP. So I want to first check that you're in favour of a cap on emissions and a carbon price, which I assume you are. But my other question is about what's the best mechanism for doing that, and when do you think we're going to see it happen? When can we get that done as a country?
Yes. Yes, the Greens do want to see a carbon levy or a carbon tax. There's nothing radical or outlandish about the policy. The policy is the policy that Ross Garnaut put forward following his commissioned report by the Rudd government. And the Greens have already made a commitment that in balance of power that they want to work with the government to bring in a carbon levy immediately. I'm talking from memory here, but I think Ross Garnaut recommended something around $23 per tonne. The commitment to capping emissions, there's a timeline in which we want to see this country at zero emissions by 2050. Now, and this is about international social responsibility. Already, India has a tax on carbon, not just for its domestic coal and carbon emissions, but anything that's imported into the country. So India, a third world country, a developing country, is already ahead of us on this. China doesn't yet have a tax on carbon, but it is way ahead of us in terms of renewable energy. Christine Milne, the Green Senator from Tasmania, has put forward plan after plan that shows it is achievable for Australia to switch to 100% renewable energy now. What we need, though, the kind of infrastructure that the country needs to make that a reality, is to put the electricity grid in place. The solar stations can't just, and the wind farms can't be put where there isn't already existing grid lines. And unless the federal government takes this issue with two hands and starts planning seriously, we will have crisscrossing lines and lines not going where the renewable sources are. But the good news is that both the geothermal energy and the best sites for solar energy are similar sites, so we could actually be putting in place the infrastructure now, and that's a big part of the Greens program, to get that done as soon as possible, both for job creation and to stop the polluting industries of coal and coal seam gas and UCG. And part of the reasons I'm perhaps sounding a little edgy tonight is I spent much of today in at the rally working with many of the farming groups that I know from the Darling Downs, who were rallying outside Parliament House today to oppose the impact that coal seam gas and coal mining and underground coal gasification are industrialising the Darling Downs and putting our food bowls at risk. So it's not just about climate change, it's about a sane, sustainable policy. And we could, you know, I don't care whether you believe in climate change or not, this is just good policy on every level in terms of Australians taking control of their energy future, doing it with the minimum harm to people and the environment.
Thank you, Olivia. I'll get Andrew to ask his second question on climate change and then invite Claire and the other panellists to respond. Andrew, your question?
So my first question was really in the mitigation, how do we reduce the effects of climate change? But my second one is directed to Family First initially, is around the impact this has on people. People in low-lying countries in the Pacific, in other parts of the world, particularly through our partner churches. The United Church has the largest range of partner churches in the Pacific, say they're already facing the prospect of losing their homes through sea level rise. Now, in the event that there's significant sea level rise that causes displacement of people, are you in support of offering Australia as a place for resettlement for those displaced by climate change?
I think I've probably got the easiest answer of the night. Absolutely. My husband and I have travelled to Bangladesh 3 times and many other countries, and Bangladesh is particularly in danger of this. And we have been in places where every year when the floods come through, people have to relocate and they're totally out of their homes. So, yes, by all means, we have to take people in. And I'd love it if Australia could get back to being known as being a compassionate country. I think we've lost that tag to a degree, and we need to open our doors to people as they need them. There's rural centres, again, as I travel through Queensland, there are rural centres crying out for people to come in and to live in the areas. So they would just welcome an influx of people. And if we could help people and help our country at the same time, that would be wonderful.
Okay. I'm going to invite Claire and Brett, maybe Brett starting with you, to pick up either of those questions, the price on carbon and the alleviation of the carbon footprint and the mitigation for, or the relief for people affected, please.
Doug, I'll give you the official coalition answer, and then I might just give, if I'm allowed to, just a quick reflection on what happened to the coalition late last year and how we didn't handle the issue very well. I mean, I don't mind admitting that in this audience, we didn't.
Look, can you use the microphone? I'm sorry.
Yes, sorry. First of all, the official position, of course, of the coalition is direct action and in a sense, encouraging companies by offering incentives rather than penalties, by sequestration and so forth. That's our way of reaching the targets, the 5% cuts by 2020. That's the official coalition policy, and everyone knows that. Whether they agree with it or not, that's the policy. Can I just say this? David, late last year, and everyone here would know this, the Coalition had enormous difficulty coming up with a policy approach to deal with one of the world's great, and Libby's right, one of the great issues facing us. And can I put it simply? Let me put it very, very simply. In the end, and Claire would know this, I crossed the floor on this and indeed resigned from the front bench to force a change. And can I just summarise the position quickly? And this is now in effect the position that in the absence of commitments from our major trading partners at the time, I believe that it would damage Australia, damage our standard of living, would not be, in fact, in our national interest to do so unless our major trading partners adopted similar policy. Why? Because in the absence of them adopting similar policies, okay, Australia contributes, what, 1.5% to the world's... Let's say 1.5. It would not affect... Sure, but still, it wouldn't. Speaking globally, it would have no effect on the environment at all. But I can say this with certainty: it would affect our economy and our standard of living. In other words, yes. Well, hold on. Yes, we should act, but it won't have any effect on the world's environment until our major trading partners do something similar. And that was the argument that carried the day. And I might add, that's the argument largely, except they're doing a different way of doing it, that the government now adopts. That's true. They're going to wait and see what our major trading partners do. That argument won the day.
Thanks, Brett. Claire, your response to those issues too.
As everyone knows, we went to the last election with a commitment to act on climate change. And we developed a process and we took it to the Parliament twice. And I think there were over 30 hours of debate in the Senate where we tried to get our policy, Andrew, which did have a cap, did have a process for having a cost and a trading price on carbon, and we couldn't get it up. And believe me, that was not through lack of trying. What we've done now is actually accepted that we did not bring the community with us in that debate. And that is to our shame that we couldn't do that. And if anyone doubts the degree of opposition there is to the change, in fact, any change, I would invite you to have a look at my email on a daily basis. And for what it's worth, the people who are absolutely opposed to change at any cost and deny the fact there's a problem outweigh the correspondence by much more than 5-1, Libby. I wish it was less than that. So we have a job to do to just make sure that people understand why there is a need to make the change. What we've done is released a series of policies which are looking at direct action, as Brett said, trying to make it easier for individuals and groups and communities to make change. We're looking at the issues around ensuring that there is more engagement with communities. We've already looked, and there's all these things are on our website, looking at the very issue that Libby brought forward about making sure that the increased expenditure which we brought forward, and we're going to bring more in terms of alternate energy, can be linked into the grid. And you're quite right, at the moment it's piecemeal, and there needs to be processes to ensure that happens more easily. That has already been released in a policy. What we want to do is ensure that we have work in the Parliament and the community that brings people together on the need to make change. We actually had the issue of Kyoto there as a point to actually work towards, to say, let's make sure that Australia has a policy which we can take to Kyoto as a global player, because we are part of a global issue, to ensure that we have effective policy. We couldn't do that because we couldn't convince our own Parliament that was the way to go. And at Kyoto, it didn't work either. Even though there was so much evidence, and Andrew, and particularly on the second question about the Pacific, there was so much gut-wrenching evidence at Kyoto about what was happening in our region. And in terms of our policy on that, the Parliamentary Secretary on the Pacific has worked very hard on that. Was Duncan Kerr before he resigned, has worked very hard with working with our Pacific neighbours specifically on a response to what will happen to what I believe is going to happen. in terms of people losing their land and their livelihood. What we've agreed is that, as in with the future policy we're going to talk about, we need to work globally on that as well. And we've committed to work with our UN neighbours to ensure that it's not just an Australian response to the Pacific, it's a Pacific and an international response to the Pacific. So our response to your second question is, yes, we have a responsibility. How it will actually play out will be a shared response, bringing everyone together to work out how it's best done. And that won't be making one agreement with one nation. We haven't got anyone from the party here. One agreement with one Pacific nation on that issue. It'll be working together. So in terms of our overall response to climate change, we have a commitment that we need to ensure that there will be change. We haven't budged. We believe that it's absolutely critical. We failed as a government to get that through Parliament. Everyone knows that debate. We need to look at it in a different way. But there's no doubt that there needs to be action. We've put complementary policies in place. The real trick will be to ensure that we are able to make everybody in our community understand the need to act and not be as divided as they currently are. And there are many other things that I can say, but I think generally to your two points, Andrew, that will be at least an opening statement.
Thank you, Claire. I'm sure there are other points that people would like to build on, but I'm going to open up the third issue and invite you to write your questions and we can return to these. But there are another couple of issues that we felt was really important to raise. That this next one has a lot of political heat in it, I suppose, sadly, because it's very much about people in distress. It's refugees and asylum seekers, and Camilla Cowley, you're going to be asking the first question.
There's a series of questions that are all interconnected, but the big topic most recently has been the regional processing centre. And my involvement began many years ago, and the terms being used then are still being used today, queue jumpers. So thousands of Afghans who have no country signatory to the convention closer than Australia to actually go to, thousands of them arrived in Indonesia, joined the UNHCR queue, were deemed to be refugees and have been waiting there for many, many years for a resettlement country. The Australian policy to date has been to take only very few of them because it is seen that taking them would create what you call a honeypot. If the UNHCR in Indonesia finds them to be refugees and Australia then takes them, the logic says that thousands more would come to Indonesia to join that queue. On this basis, is a regional processing facility, whether it be in East Timor or Nauru, which is funded by Australia, just going to cause another honeypot? And where should those fleeing places like Afghanistan in particular go to join a queue from which they have any hope of resettlement? Because quite honestly, other countries around the world see those in Indonesia who have been found to be refugees to be our responsibility.
That question, I think, originally is going to Brett.
Well, I think both Brett and Claire.
Just briefly for each of you, please. Senator Mason, we'll start with you.
Sure. Camilla, thanks.
Again, the microphone. Sorry.
I always forget. All right, I apologise. Sorry.
Dementia.
It is dementia. It must be hereditary. Camilla, you're right. Clearly, under the UN Refugee Convention, I did my research this afternoon. You join the queue in the first or nearest country which is a signatory to the convention. I think that's right, isn't it? That's the rule. All right. The bottom line is there are about 15 to 20 million people in effect who are refugees in the world at the moment. Something like that. Something like that. And we take in Australia about 13,750. Let's say 15,000 a year. That's in effect the cap. The issue for, well, when we're in government, and it's the same for the current government, the issue is who do you let in? Do you let in, because there are plenty of people qualify as refugees, as I say, 15 to 20 million people. Do you let the people in who can somehow make their way to Indonesia
Either they pay to get there or they get there some other way. Or do you take people that may have been sitting in a refugee camp in Kenya, you know, for 10 years with a penniless widow that may have even a stronger case? Do you take them? Because you can't take everyone. Now, I've worked, and Camilla knows this, for the UN in a human rights component in the 90s in Cambodia. You know, I've been to refugee camps in Arunna Prathet, just after the war, after Pol Pot was thrown out, and, of course, the Vietnamese government came in, and there were refugees all throughout Western Thailand. And, sure, at one level, all of these people are refugees, and at one level, we would love to take them all, but we can't. And so, in a sense, you have to prioritise who gets in. And the way we do it, I think at the moment, the way the current government does it is, if not perfect, about right. It's a very, very difficult issue. All issues tonight, Camilla, are difficult. But it's a very difficult issue. I don't know. Do you take people that can get to Indonesia, one way or another, whether they pay a people smuggler or not, or do you take the penniless widow in Kenya who's been there for 10 years with her kids? It's difficult.
Claire.
Our policy has been clearly to look at a combined response in this area, and I have great difficulty talking about people as a group or as some kind of mass, because in my eyes I see the individuals, most of whom, the ones who have come to Australia, you get to know and you see and you hear about their stories. In terms of what our position is in terms of the future, we have agreed that there needs to be a regional United Nations response to the global issue, and I use these terms again because they are, as Bert's put the numbers out in terms of the numbers that are across the world displaced for any number of reasons, and we just can't talk about Afghanistan in isolation, Camilla. When we're talking about Afghanistan, as Bert's already done, you bring in the competing needs of a whole range of people who are fleeing countries for genuine reason. And there has been various forms of regulation over the preceding years. Some have failed dismally. Some have attempted to work. We have to balance, and I know that word gets very tiresome to keep talking about balance. We have to talk about balancing, treating individuals with respect through whatever system they are, because there will always be a system. It doesn't matter which government is in place. There will be a system, because there will not be open entry to our country ever again. That's not going to happen. So there'll be a system of some sort in place, and in that process what we have to do is make sure that people who are caught up in that system are treated with respect and dignity and not made to feel even worse than they have in the past. So the Gillard plan is to actually have a regional UN-endorsed UNHCR process in a place to be agreed, and it has not been agreed yet, but in a place that is signatory to the UN Convention, so that they're already bound by an international agreement, and that the responsibility is shared. There are concerns about the treatment of people in Indonesia, and people who've had the opportunity to visit some of the camps in Indonesia have come back with some pretty rough stories about the conditions are not to the level that we would expect people to be treated. And there are international discussions between Australia and Indonesia on that point. What we have to do is agree what is the right way of assessment, and there will always be an assessment, and the Australian assessment is based on the UNHCR process, and it has not changed. People who are seeking asylum in this country have to prove themselves that they are in a refugee situation through the UNHCR. They have to prove their identity and their health status, and that's been the same. What our government has done has changed a whole lot of other things, and I won't go into that now, but you know what they are. But in terms of the regional solution and your question, we believe it needs to be a regional solution again. We don't know. We are actually working, and we'll continue to work with governments to see where that can be. We are not precluding, as Wendy has talked about, looking at solutions that engage with communities in Australia. We are not putting anything out of the question. But there's no answer that I can give that will actually address the individual needs of the people who are so traumatised. So we are sticking by the UN process.
Camilla, do you want to ask your second question?
Yes, I do. to me, the main difference between the Labor policy and the Liberal coalition policy, when we come talking about those who arrive by boats, is TPVs, the reintroduction of temporary protection visas, and I think most Australians are aware of the trauma that was visited upon people, not only the detention, but then the waiting for many, many years. And Brett knows about it because he met quite a few of the young guys of Tigers. So we have two different questions really tied into the one, because there is no suggestion that the Labor Party will introduce temporary protection visas. And then we come to the question where this is seen as the honeypot that's drawing more boats. But we need to look at the fact that the numbers of boats actually rose after the introduction of the temporary protection visas back in 1999. The boats stopped coming when it seemed the Taliban had been defeated in Afghanistan. The boat numbers have risen again as those Hazaras in Afghanistan have realised that the Taliban has not been defeated. So, do you still believe that the TPVs are a deterrent? Do you believe, this will be to you first, Brett, do you believe that reopening Nauru, which will not be considered a regional processing centre, will it be in reopening Nauru and reintroducing temporary protection visas, do you see this as really a deterrent? Because most of those who were traumatised in Nauru for some years were eventually accepted in Australia, are probably nearly all Australian citizens now, so you would nearly think that it would be a means of punishing, not deterring, because it doesn't hold water as being a deterrent anymore.
Brett, I'm going to ask you to answer that, and then I'm going to invite Libby and Wendy to make a comment about the issues that we've talked about with asylum seekers. Thanks, Brett.
Thanks. You always ask such easy questions, Camilla, to answer. Fortunately, I did a little bit of homework because this actually is a complicated question. The Coalition does, yes, agree on offshore processing, and the Coalition's position would be that has operated as a deterrent, in effect. That would be the Coalition position. But can I say this, because this is actually quite technical. You ask, will the processing of asylum seekers in regional processing facilities and the reintroduction of TPVs be fully compliant with the Refugee Convention? Yes, it will. All right, so that's on the record. Yes, it will. Then you ask, with due process and rights to appeal? Yes, in the sense that the UNHCR guidelines will be followed. But, Camilla, of course, Australian law will not operate. You ask about rights to appeal and due process. Rights to appeal will operate under the UN Convention rather than Australian law because it's offshore processing. People follow that? So the applicable law will be the international law rather than Australian domestic law. And finally, you ask, and will those deemed to be refugees be given a place in Australia, or will you expect other countries to take these refugees? And the answer is they will be assessed and resettled where they are accepted. And you are right that in the past, and you and I have discussed this elsewhere, that in the past many have been accepted here in Australia. But, of course, the official answer would be they will be accepted and resettled where they are accepted.
Libby, can I invite you to say, what's the Greens policy? It is a complex issue with deep humanitarian moral concerns as well. Practical politics comes into it. Just briefly, what's the Greens' position on those issues we've raised?
Okay. Well, obviously, no offshore processing. It's deeply offensive, and it's just interesting to see the way the two major parties have come together again. And it's just disheartening to hear this talk that, we can't cope with the numbers of people, you know, we'll abide by the UNHCR when we're not even matching our commitments, funding commitments for the UNHCR. We don't meet international guidelines and our overseas aid. If we really want to be a responsible
international citizen and not take responsibility for the vast numbers of refugees in our own region, you would think both major parties would therefore say, oh, well, maybe we should do our share to help these international agencies who are trying to manage this immense social problem. But no, we just get this inward-looking response from both major parties that appeals to the worst in Australians. And as an historian, I know that is not an accurate reflection of the Australian community. I was teaching this week on the foundation of the UN. Australia played such an important part on the world stage after World War II, and our message was, we're a small nation. We want to see a UN in which the rights of small nations will be respected, because the only way you can have a safe and secure world is when we all act with decency to one another and respect our separate rights. And yet, you know, here's Australia admitting it's a small country. We can't cope with this big refugee problem. We can afford to send troops overseas, but we can't afford to do the right thing. And I just wish them, both major parties would stop this language, such as honeypot, which is code for saying, yes, feel resentful towards these people when they are victims. So one of the first important points to note about the Greens' policy is we would rescind the fake migration zone and resort to our true national borders, which was simply put in place to make it more difficult for refugees. And we would accept the processing of asylum seekers in Australia under a much more humane process. We want to see processes for proper review, not just decisions made by the minister. And if the minister doesn't, you know, if you're not deemed to be a genuine refugee, then the minister can give you a humanitarian visa and the minister can rescind that if they so choose. Well, we think it's time that there were proper, open and accountable processes put in place, and that the only way in which you're going to deal with the deep personal problems that refugees bring to this country is by locating them in the community and making normal services available to them so that they can work, so that they can afford to pay for healthcare and so on. And that's going to be the way in which you would have a fair and just and humane policy, and then Australians would feel less afraid of people and realise what a wonderful contribution refugees have made to this country and will continue to make, and what generous people they will be when they are accepted and welcomed in our community.
Thank you. Libby and Wendy.
As a Christian, I can't help but ask the question, there but by the grace of God go I. So every time I hear about the asylum seekers and the refugees, my heart is hurting, because they are people like you and I. It's a very difficult question, and I don't doubt that the major parties are wanting to do what is best, but I also don't doubt that the major parties are using it as a political game as well, and I do think that they do whip up fear in the community that is not necessarily there and not reflected by the Australian people. Because I see, when I go around, that the Australian people actually really welcome the refugees. And in any situation that I've been in, and my husband and I have looked after a number of different refugee-type people in different communities, so the Sudanese down in the Logan area and that sort of thing. And, you know, the people just gather around them and love them to bits and help them so much. So I think the Australian people are ready to welcome people in. And I do think that the Family First policy is actually to have hostel-type facilities, and these would be in rural areas, and we would have the ability to teach English, they would be able to work, there would be recreation, there would be access to medical and legal consultations, but there would be also supervision of those hostel facilities until the people were able to be cleared of medical or any possible danger to Australia at all. You know, so they would have to be cleared. But I do think that we need to foster an attitude in Australia of loving our neighbour and being prepared to help those who really can't help themselves at the moment.
Thanks, Wendy. We move on to Indigenous Affairs, I think, and come back to... There's one more question on asylum seekers and a number from the audience as well, but I think we'll cover, move into Indigenous Affairs and make sure that we've covered well the four main issues that were proposed for tonight, and then move into returning to some of these issues. Andrew, you've got a question on Indigenous disadvantage.
Yep.
This is firstly directed to the Greens, but hoped it might open up this issue more broadly as well. The churches all welcomed the bipartisan apology to the Stolen Generations, which was a feature of the last Parliament. And we looked forward to a greater priority being given to Indigenous policy. But given that the Indigenous constituency and therefore its political influence is so small, and yet the issues of Indigenous disadvantage and dispossession are such a moral stain on our history as a nation, what priority should be given to those policy issues, particularly the question of reparations, land rights and improved health outcomes, education and housing outcomes?
Libby.
Thanks, Andrew. Yes, it's a fundamental moral question, so it should... actual population numbers and the amount of pressure Indigenous organisations can exert on the political process should be irrelevant. It is what we need to do to again build a compassionate society based on reconciliation and respect for difference. The Greens are committed to signing a treaty and having that treaty recognised in the Constitution. We're also committed to... I know we've got limited time, but there's something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 royal commissions and inquiries that have been held going back to 1991 and the Aboriginal deaths in custody, in which governments of both persuasions have failed to enact the recommendations. In other words, we've had inquiry after inquiry. We know what we need to do to help build the Indigenous community so that their standard of living is the same as the mainstream Australians, and to respect their particular needs and to overcome the legacy of disadvantage. But that's 7 royal commissions and inquiries dating back 19 years, and we just haven't had the political will to follow through on them. So that's the first step, and that includes that issue of reparations, particularly for the Stolen Generations and for the Little Children, a Sacred Report, both of which talk about the need for reparations. But just to give one more example, one of the scandals in Queensland is the stolen and unpaid wages going, you know, right back to the early 20th century when the Queensland government, it was a legacy of the 20th century, it was governments of all persuasions, lost the files showing where the Aboriginal wages had been retained by the government. So they admitted this, and it was good to see that the Bligh government and Beattie government both said they would do something about this. But what did they do? It was an appalling and insulting offer that was made, and many Indigenous people didn't accept it. And when there was this body of money left over, because Indigenous people were insulted by what the government had offered... I'll get that later, Brett... The Queensland minister said, well, we'll put it into Aboriginal education. Now, why should Aboriginal people have their unpaid wages put into education when the rest of us get our education for free? It was just insulting. So the key points in our policy are that Indigenous Australians are entitled to exactly the same housing, health and education services as the mainstream. There shouldn't be any distinguishing or special treatment or conditions put upon that. It is the responsibility of government to make sure all Australians get those services. And I mean, the fact that we haven't done it means that the argument for sovereignty on the Aboriginal side is really strong. We've had more than 200 years in which we've claimed this is, you know, white Australian British territory and then white Australian territory, and yet government still can't administer remote Australia where large numbers of Aboriginal people lived. Well, to me that says maybe your legal thinking is a bit wrong there, and if you really want to prove that, then maybe you should get out there and start delivering services on the ground and stop blaming Aboriginal people when they live in overcrowded houses or don't have the same education levels as the rest of Australia.
Andrew, you'd hope that that might open up a broader conversation. Yeah. I'm going to ask 60 seconds from the other three people on the general question, because it is not a big vote winner, it's not a big public front policy for electioneering about what we will do about Indigenous disadvantage, at least not that I've heard in this campaign. But I would like 60 seconds from you about what does your party believe is the appropriate level of priority and attention to be paid to this issue? Thanks, Wendy.
There's no doubt that we owe the Aboriginal people an enormous amount, particularly financially. because we, and when I say we, I'm talking White Australia, we came in and we just camped on their land and took it. So there's none of us who haven't benefited from that. And so what I would really love to see, and this is not a Family First policy, but it is something that we are talking about wanting to try and get out there, because Family First is a real grassroots party, so we can get out and really speak to people. I would like every single church in Queensland to be the ones to actually do something, because do you know what? The governments can't do it, because they've shown us over and over again they're not doing anything and they can't do it. We were all really happy to hear the sorry, but there's been nothing happened since the sorry. So if every single church in Queensland took it on their plates to actually do something to reach out to the Aboriginal community and to actually support an Aboriginal mission or support Rotary or whoever's doing something in the Aboriginal communities, or support the Aboriginal people in the way that they would want us to, and ask them. Do you know, there's no one who can actually speak for the Aboriginal people, because they all have different elders and they all have different ways that they govern. So we need to talk to them. And if every church in Queensland, you imagine across every denomination, actually led the way and did something about it, boy, that'd be great.
Thanks, Wendy. Brett.
Thanks. Again, welfare alone isn't the key. I mean, you people like Noel Pearson, indeed Wayne Swan has said, you know, the welfare drip has been killing Aboriginal people. If I had to nominate two keys to it, it's opportunity and education. And I agree, actually, with Libby about the quality of schools. It's a fact that Indigenous and non-Indigenous kids going to school in, let's say, central Brisbane, have quite similar results, quite similar. Yet as the schools become more remote, the difference between Aboriginal kids and non-Indigenous and Indigenous kids and non-Indigenous kids becomes greater and greater and greater. In other words, the problem isn't indigeneity, the problem is the quality of the education.
Claire.
As we said, when we came to government, it's a high priority for the Labor government. We said that with the apology. We put that there. It's disappointing that Wendy believes nothing has happened since the apology. I think if you have a look at the record, there has been unprecedented action in the last 3 years. Whether, in fact, it has been effective in every case, I cannot make that guarantee. But in terms of where this government has put priority in health, in education, in housing, the numbers speak for themselves. The numbers also say we haven't concluded it and we haven't done enough. But it doesn't help when actually the work that has been done is not seen. And in terms of what I can put forward is what has been 3 years of action led by a minister who truly cares in this area and a high priority in cabinet decisions. And in fact, there is not a single cabinet decision which does the impact on the Aboriginal community is not taken into account. So in terms of process, of course we can do more. Of course we must do more. And that will happen. But in terms of reparation, I'll put it on the table. At this stage, the Labor Party does not support individual reparation for Aboriginal people. We've said consistently that we think that the best way to handle it is to look at significant funding, and when I say significant, I mean significant funding, into education, health, housing, community development, and that's what our policy is. And I know that that is not universally accepted, but we as a Labor Party have never had a policy of individual reparation. So in terms of the future, I'm happy to look at individual issues, but in the policy area, it has been a core area. One of the very important areas, though, is where we actually at the national level have Aboriginal voices. And in Parliament now we don't at the federal level, and that is an issue, though not one single voice, not one person can represent a whole culture. So I think when we have in the past had individuals in Parliament, there's been an undue expectation that they will be able to work miracles. And I think certainly Senator Bonner and then Senator Ridgway both suffered, I think, from an expectation that they alone could make a change. But it is a shame in our political system that but we've talked about it ourselves many times, that we don't have Aboriginal people being elected into our parliaments, and that's an issue for all of us to look at. One of the questions, and it's further down the track, and I don't know who is going to own it, is about the Congress and how that will operate. And I think that leads into there as well. The Congress is relatively new. We actually believe as a government that it has a core role in working with parliaments, not just federal parliament, and community and organisations to ensure that there is a point of consultation and discussion and engagement, because since ATSIC was wiped out, there has not been such a body. And ATSIC, with all its failings, actually did have a point of contact. So I think it leads on to that area. But to say nothing has happened is incorrect. To say not enough has happened is also a correct statement.
Thanks, Claire. You're talking about the National Congress of Australian First Peoples.
Yes.
Correct.
Congress,
indeed, just in case people weren't aware. Camilla, one more question at the moment on this question of Indigenous Affairs, please.
Well, I wanted to ask whether all of the candidates support the continuation of the intervention in the Northern Territory as it presently operates, and if not, what would they do instead to improve the safety, health and, in particular, education of Indigenous children on remote communities? And added to that, make sure that there is due consultation with these communities.
So the intervention, Brett, I might give that to you first, seeing as it happened under the Howard government, and then invite each of the candidates a brief response.
Yeah, sure, I'll be quick. Yes, Camilla, the intervention was necessary, and we think, and indeed should remain. Something had to be done to break the cycle of violence and alcohol and substance abuse, and let's face it, perhaps the most fundamental human right is the right to personal safety or non-molestation. And only when you can guarantee that on Aboriginal communities can you make any sort of progress. And I agree with Claire. You said before there have been strides under the past government and the current government in relation to Indigenous affairs. There is, in fact, a closing of the gap. It might be too slow, but it's not all bad. And health, Indigenous health relative to non-Indigenous health is getting better. So I don't want to be totally negative. People say, it's all bad. It isn't all bad.
So the intervention continues?
Yes, the intervention continues.
Okay. Claire, invite you next, and then invite Libby and Wendy.
I think it's really sad that we're still calling it the intervention. The intervention happened. We didn't agree with the way it happened, but in terms of the focus it put onto the issues, I think that in itself was a good thing. The intervention process occurred, and our government has come in, and we are working with what came out of that. So the programs and the policies in terms of focusing on health, focusing on education, ensuring that people have the right to speak out, having access to services on communities which were never there. We are strongly supporting those policies. The most controversial aspect is welfare quarantining, and I can talk all night on that subject and you don't want me to. But in terms of the process, this government actually brought forward legislation which looked at the issue of welfare quarantining. We did three things. First of all, we made sure that it was not the Racial Discrimination Act was not removed from the process, and we restored the Racial Discrimination Act without limitation into the legislation. Secondly, we said that welfare quarantining, which for it's false, is not the only aspect of what happened with the intervention, but when you talk with people, it seems that's the only thing they know about, the fact that there was a change to the way Centrelink payments were received by people who lived in certain areas. We changed that prescription, that it was a locationally based change, to a legislation that was coming into effect on the 1st of July 2010, but the election process has kind of overcome that. Looking at the process of welfare quarantining will be a model for how people who are on long-term payments will actually interact with Centrelink. And there's lots of controversy about that. And we could talk about the consultation process, which was extensive. It was not perfect. A lot of people don't like what's happening, but there was a genuine attempt to have consultation. We have made that now a process that is part of the Centrelink system. The good thing about that is for the very first time, and I worked for many years in the Department of Social Security, there will be a genuine data collection for the impact of the process.
It is a very sad fact that lots of people talk about the way welfare interrelates with people, but there's very limited data anywhere that shows the impact on people, their livelihoods, their ability to access work, all those things, pay bills. I'm sorry I'm taking a long time on this, but it's a core aspect of the issue that should not be called intervention. It should be called ongoing process for interaction as opposed to the intervention, because you're already labelling it before you're looking at what's happening on the ground. This is no longer, the welfare quarantining is no longer an issue only for Aboriginal people. I take the point that in the first process, many Aboriginal people will be caught up in it, because what's happening is it's being introduced in the Northern Territory first, the whole of the Northern Territory, not just prescribed areas, to make sure that the system is operational and able to be used. So it's a very important issue. It is not an easy one, and I draw all your attention to the Senate inquiry on this legislation. And if it's something you care to read, please read the 270 pages of that report, because I helped write it. And I was the chair of that committee, so it's a very sensitive issue. We stand by the point that this is a way forward, but it has to be done with people, not to people, and that's where I come again. Having government separated from community will always have people removing themselves from the discussion. The whole focus of the way welfare quarantining is supposed to work is it interacts between the person and others, so that you're not left alone and in isolation. So if you're going to ask a question about intervention, you're going to get a long answer.
You're going to get a big answer. That's a complicated question. Libby.
You can talk more about welfare quarantining at the next forum.
Yes.
If the government had listened to advice from those many royal commissions and inquiries, some of which, such as the Women's Inquiry, Aboriginal Women's Report into Domestic Violence in Queensland, they would have come up with a very different solution. There wouldn't have been the Northern Territory intervention. There wouldn't have been social welfare quarantining. There would have been realistic programs on the ground. And I was a bit disappointed earlier, Bruce, when you made this allusion. I was about to tell the story about Bruce Trevorrow. That's why I got the name wrong. Sorry. After I spoke about, you know, the need for matching health and education and housing, that the assumption was, that we're talking about welfare. Absolutely not. The government should have gone into the Northern Territory and trained their Indigenous people longing for traineeships and apprenticeships. They want to build their own homes. They want the skills. The difficulty is they don't necessarily want to leave their families and their communities to do the really difficult training, which is generally only available in capital cities, and they don't have the resources in those capital cities to live on, and it's really daunting, and it's daunting for white students, and it's daunting for Aboriginal students. So you could have done a reconstruction process from the ground up in which you trained people to build sustainable communities. And believe me, the many much advice that government has been given by Indigenous women about the problems of domestic violence have not involved a heavy-handed government approach. They do want community policing and proper nighttime policing. That's another essential that they have asked for, but they do not necessarily want punitive approaches to alcohol and to substance abuse. It's all there. We've got the Indigenous advice, and it's so sad to hear both sides major parties resorting to patronising responses to Aboriginal people like, oh, no, we couldn't give individual reparations, or we couldn't possibly have an elected Indigenous Congress of First Peoples. I just find it astonishing, and which was why I was thinking about Bruce Trevorrow. And what the government is saying when it says, no, we couldn't possibly have individual reparations, is you, as a community, you're going to have to get to the courts and fight one by one and go through the pain of that legal process. And Bruce Trevorrow was one lucky Indigenous man who survived the Indigenous process, and the court said, my God, this story of this man stolen as a one-year-old child by a hospital is appalling. He must be paid reparations. And sadly, Bruce died within 6 months of that landmark judgment, and of course it was tragic that in that 6 months he knew that the South Australian government was taking it back to the court to try and dispute the decision.
And that's essentially the callous attitude that the government is taking when they say, oh, we'll make the decisions for you. Of course we'll listen to you, so maybe. We'll let you talk to us and maybe we'll listen to you. But, you know, you can write those really long reports with all your personal experience in them, but we don't have to act on the recommendations. Well, 19 years is enough of the reports and inquiries. Listen to the Indigenous community. The answers are all coming from them.
Thanks, Libby. Wendy.
We spotted the intervention when it happened, but by all means we need to protect our Australian children, and that includes white and Indigenous Australians. So we have to stop the cycle of poverty and the dependency on government money, and that is only going to happen when governments and communities work together. I think we've got to cooperate with the Indigenous leaders themselves, the community leaders. They've got the track record of knowing what's best for their communities. It's not just one leader, it's all of them. We've got to listen to them, and the children must be a priority because the children are the future, and they must be the priority and they must be protected. Different ways of learning need to be also implemented. Sometimes when you move out into the Indigenous communities, they don't want to learn or want to do assignments even the same way as other schools might want to do. And so we've got to look at different ways of education. We've got to think laterally, and we've got to think as we've got to ask them and talk to the community leaders, talk to people.
Thanks, Wendy. There are a couple other questions from the panel, but we've opened the four issues that the panel decided were really critical for tonight. And I hope that there are some questions circulating that you've written as you've listened that we can now begin to feed in and offer to the panel. So if you have got some questions, please write them and signal to Sean or to Shana that you are wanting to put a question in that form to them. I've got a couple of questions that have come in relation to the asylum seeker issue. So I'm going to return to that issue now because these questions have come for the floor. The first one is, will any of the major parties, or any of the parties here, sorry, commit themselves to processing asylum seekers in metropolitan centres on mainland Australia within the next 3 years? Libby, I heard you quite emphatically say that Green's policy was to do that, but there's a challenge for the other three parties, and I'm just going to invite, it's only a 30-second response, it's really a yes or a no with perhaps a sentence or two of comment about your answer. So Claire, then Brett, then Wendy.
It's not our policy.
I beg your pardon?
It's not our policy.
And do you want to just one sentence say why?
We've explained that in terms of the process, we're looking at an international response, and we're looking at processing in terms of a regional response, not on mainland Australia.
Thanks, Claire. Brett?
Similar from the coalition, and of course adopting UNHCR guidelines as the appropriate law to be followed in the resolution of those applications.
That's what we want, rural Australia with hostel type accommodation.
Okay, so you're supporting the question?
Yes.
Mainland processing within 3 years?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. There's a second question on asylum seekers that I might actually put as well. The question is, why does the coalition persist in calling asylum seekers illegal immigrants or acting illegally? I'm not sure that, Brett, your party is the only one that might do that, and maybe not everyone in your party does it anyway. It's certainly part of the political jargon, though. We talk about illegal immigrants or queue jumpers. But this questioner asks, please name the laws which they break by crossing a border without a visa. So maybe we might just get the legality question addressed first. And Brett, I will actually ask you to do that. In what sense are they illegal immigrants?
Well, you can't just cross into another country without permission. I mean, there are no open borders. But in a sense, refugees are an exception to that rule, if that makes sense.
Yep.
I mean, I can't just walk into another country just because I want to go there. The world doesn't work like that, without a visa. The exception is if I'm a refugee. So in a sense, when people arrive by boat, or indeed, you know, by aircraft, which either way, the assumption with people coming by boat is that it's illegal technically, in the sense that, prima facie, it's illegal because they don't have a visa or permission to enter the country. Does anyone follow that? On the face of it, it is. And then when they approve, as indeed, Camilla, you said this, many prove refugee status, and I accept that. Then, of course, the exception is proven and there's nothing illegal about their conduct.
Okay. The next question is, under the Howard government... I'm sorry, Claire, I do apologise.
The point is that the media has actually picked up on that term, And I think you're quite right in that it's not a term that Bert uses. And I've not heard you use it anyway, Bert.
But
in terms of process, the discussion and the debate must be about the role of asylum seekers. And we try very strenuously to maintain that terminology. But if you open the newspaper or you listen to the radio, what happens is you hear the alternate. And that's the real sadness that's happened in this debate, that because of things that have occurred, there's this community thing, and I know that one of the things we must do is actually have ongoing community education. And I think that that's one of the core challenges to no matter which party you're in. But the question actually reflects the stuff that you see in the media.
Thank you. Look, the final question I've got on that at the moment is also a brief one. Under the Howard government, temporary protection for confirmed real refugees kept families separated. Is this humane in keeping with the rights of the child, and will you really do it again?
Well, I mentioned before about a policy on temporary protection visas. They will be administered in accordance with international law.
So is the answer that it would be different from last time or the same as last time?
Well, it'll be administered in accordance with international law. I mean, that's all I can say. Well, I don't. I don't know more than that. I don't know more than that. But I can say that if you're asking whether it will be legal, yes, it will be.
Well, I think the question really is it humane? And does it respect the rights of the child?
Hold on.
So legality may be...
Someone said... Hold on. I said before, I think, and I wasn't trying to mislead anyone, that the coalition will be following UNHCR guidelines. Now, you can dispute whether we're going to do that, but that's our policy, that we will be following international law and the convention. The difference is, because it's offshore processing, Australian domestic law will not be applied.
Okay. Just trying to make sure that...
Is it humane, Brett? That was the rider. Do you consider it humane to keep families separated?
Is all law humane? Probably not.
Okay, we're going to go to climate change. A question, Brett, to you again, but I'm going to invite the others to comment as well. Brett Mason quotes us as producing 1.5% of emissions and we're taking less than 0.1% of refugees. Why does our nation punch above our weight in causing problems but underperform in solving them?
Australia takes 13,750 refugees per year. And I'm sure Claire will confirm this. We receive more refugees per capita than any other nation on earth. Yes, we do. That's a fact.
But Wendy, do you want to make a comment?
Clearly, when you have as large an immigration program as Australia does, there's room there for us to be doing more in terms of refugees. And that's essentially our immigration policy, which would be to direct a greater proportion towards asylum seekers and family reunions and away from the skilled migration, which is being used to de-skill Australia or not pay for the true skilling of Australia. And of course, the other problem with our skilled migration program is that we're actually, in a sense, stealing the educated members of developing countries. So, you know, it's unfair at both ends. And so we think the balance should be shifted. And in that way, we could do much more towards our international responsibilities towards the world's refugee problem.
I think all I'd just say is that asylum seekers have already suffered enormous traumatic experiences in their own home country, so all we can do to make that least traumatic when they get here, the better.
Okay. Thank you. That introduced us to climate change. There's a question here. The questioner says, I first heard of climate change in 1988. Maybe some of us heard it even prior to that in different forms. Keating raised it in the mid-90s. The question says, why is Senator Mason and the Coalition so late and so slow in coming to the party? And there might be a second part to this in terms of why do the parties believe there is still no community consensus when clearly they have voted for parties with strong climate change policy? I might get Brett and Claire to respond to that, please.
The community consensus that people talk about depends on a couple of things. It is true that most Australians want action on climate change. That's true. That I accept. But if you ask them this question, should Australia act in the absence of action by our major overseas competitors, you know what most Australians say? No. They say no. That's the fact. Now, the dissonance, the distance between those two points is where we have to travel. I accept, and I'm not, as Claire knows, a climate change denier, and in fact most of the coalition isn't. Some are. Some are, but most aren't. Most people think in the coalition that we need to have an insurance policy, or what does Rupert Murdoch say? We should be giving the planet the benefit of the doubt. That would certainly be my view, without any doubt. But the distance between those... Most Australians think we should do something, that's true, but do most Australians believe that we should act before other nations act in concert with us? And according, and if we do act, it will mean it will affect our standard of living and will not be in our national interest. No.
Claire, your comment on that?
I'm always worried by people who say that they're speaking for most Australians. It doesn't matter on what issue, because every poll that says one thing, someone who has a different view can produce an alternate poll that says the other. So it always concerns me when people say, I speak on behalf of most Australians. What was indicated in the extensive debate about climate change in the last period of government was that there is a difference of opinion in the community. There is not a genuine consensus, but I'm not sure whether there's a genuine consensus on anything in this country. I think people will always have different views, but what we saw was that people had significant concerns and worries, particularly when it came down to taking action. And when action impacted on economic change, that was when people were most outraged by the whole process. So we have a considerable job to do to actually bring people on side with it. But it scares me, as I said, David, when people speak on behalf of most Australians, because whilst people who feel that way can produce a poll, I have regular correspondence, and I know them well, to my office that can produce alternate polls and alternate very strongly and passionately believed statements that they think that there should be something different. So I don't believe there is an absolute consensus, as that question says, but I think there's... I believe that there is a need to act, so it's our job in government to make sure that we bring people with us.
Marcus, we've covered this a little bit, but I'm going to ask Libby and Wendy for a brief comment in relation particularly to a commitment by the Australian people for action that may be costly. I mean, I think this is where the political heat is in this question.
Well, I mean, what's not being said is both major parties ran scared of the massive vested interests that the mining industry represents in this country. And they weren't prepared, and we saw that with the resources tax, mining resources super profits tax, and the Labor Party really felt, you know, the force of that industry when they suggested that. And that's exactly the issue that it was with climate change. As they've both said, there's a majority of members of both sides of Parliament who know climate change is real. And the environment movement has been saying this for 30 years. The renewables make sense. They make sense for ordinary people. They create jobs. They make us energy independent. They don't cause pollution. The only reason we are having this blockage is because there is so much money tied up by individuals who own coal mines and gas. And instead of being open and honest about it to get the climate change policy through, the government cowered. Both parties cowered over it. And that's been even more the case with the tax. They didn't want that huge advertising campaign waged against them. But the fact is, yeah, polling after polling showed that the majority of Australians supported action on climate change. And always, when you give people the options of renewable energy, they always say, yes, that makes sense. It's pollution-free. It's cheap in the long term. But instead, we let industry run scared. I mean, that's happening at the moment on the Darling Downs. I know I have to be quick, David.
Yep, yep.
But the reality is the coal seam gas people are saying, but we're bringing jobs. The state government's saying, we're bringing jobs. It means that we're going to lose long-term farming jobs and long-term soil production. Mm. You know, so in fact, they're rarely actually new jobs. Alternative energy will also produce lots of jobs, but the problem is there's no multinationals putting significant investment in it. It's all been small scale. The Chinese have put more into it than we have, so maybe soon we'll have the Chinese coming to Australia to sell us
some of their renewable technology and promises jobs, because until that happens and there's a rival power, because government will not take the initiative, we're going to be stuck in this crazy debate.
Wendy,
there's no doubt that we haven't looked after our world, but I don't think that the governments have done very well at educating us on the issues and how we can be responsible, and then the people might actually support some of their initiatives if they just understood them. I don't think we understand a lot of things. I think the average person doesn't. And if you see that the way that when we had the water crisis, it was very well explained, and we all did our part, and look how good we did. We did so well when we understood what the issue was, and we cut down our water usage and right across the state, and that was resolved. But I don't think that we're being explained to what we can actually do, and it's amazing what people can do if they understand. And as soon as we understood about the water, we responded and we did well. So we need the governments to stop playing the big games with their back and forward and the political games, and we need them to explain it so that we can actually respond.
Claire, can I ask you a 30-second response to this question? Why does climate change require a consensus when the intervention didn't? And perhaps to say, rather than just the intervention, at what point do you... at what point is leadership about gathering consensus and not taking hard decisions? I think that might be part of where that question's coming from. You've got a brief response.
It's a bit of both in terms of the responsibility of government. But a government that does not have a genuine understanding of the decisions they're making, whether you agree or not, is not doing their job. So I think it's one of those clever questions, and I think the same person who did those stats earlier could have asked that question in terms of comparing immigration and use of energy. But in terms of process, you need to actually ensure that the community knows what's happening and why, and that is good government. So I don't think it's a fair comparison with the intervention, because there was a whole range of things that went before, and I remind you it wasn't our government that did it. So just be very clear about that. In terms of process, I think there is a place for leadership, but leadership without understanding is not an effective community, I don't believe. It comes close to being an autocratic dictatorship. Because sometimes things that people impose do work, but is that the kind of community we want in our country? I don't think so.
But I know that's more than 30 seconds. That's okay. That's fine. I just want to change tack a little bit to schools, which is an issue we haven't yet covered, but someone has asked a question which I think is worth ventilating. They expressed the view, since the national curriculum under Labor has been so blandly disappointing... So there's the assumption, or there's the declaration. What would the Coalition, if elected, do to ensure that it does become a 21st century curriculum for our schools? Brett.
Sure.
30 seconds. 45 seconds, it's a new topic.
Well, the issue is still being ventilated. In fact, the discussion is still going on about the content of the national curriculum. Can I say, Claire will be shocked to hear me say this, but I agree largely with what the government has done on the national curriculum. In other words, I think it's good to have a common curriculum throughout the country. Because I think it's good for standards to be similar. I think it's a good thing when people move into state. Australians are a very mobile people. I think it makes sense. The next issue, though... well, sir, even if assuming you're right, it's good to have what we might call world's best practice. All right. In other words, if we can get the best practice in the world adopted here in Australia, I think that's a good thing. The issue, however, and this is becoming tighter and tighter and tighter, is the assessment that's going to be adopted. You know, my view, and this is not the Coalition's official view, but it's my personal view as spokesman on the issue, is that there should be common national assessment. Because that would, in a sense, standards therefore would become uniform. And Bob Carr, for example, believes in that. But I'll be honest, most educators in Queensland don't. They think their system is better. In New South Wales, they think their assessment system is better. And you know what? The Victorians think their assessment system is better. Just like the mental health. So at least I think, and this is where I do agree with the government, I think the idea, even if we can't get common national assessment, I think a common national curriculum is a very good thing in principle.
Can I? So let's then move on. There's another question here. What are the party's policies regarding state aid for religious schools? There's an easy topic to unpack briefly, with not much history behind it.
For me?
I think we might, in fact, invite each of the four, because education and state support for private schools, religious schools, is a, you know, it's an emblematic issue of church-state relationships and so on. So we might invite from Claire down, and again, just a brief response so we can...
Julia released a policy yesterday in terms of reinforcing the fact that we will be supporting people's choice in education, and that will mean that there won't be extra money for private schools over public schools, but that anyone in the country, regardless of where they're going to school, provided they operate within the set curriculum and actually are providing an education that links to that, will be appropriately funded.
Thank you. Libby?
Can I also just quickly make a comment on the previous question, which was that
yep.
You know, world's best practice is really damaging our education institutions, because what it means is, I mean, I see the way it operates at the university sector, and it's just an excuse for making things like Queensland studies and local studies irrelevant. And the pressure on university students these days is horrendous. Now we're going to make it all the way down to the primary school level. And so there is a connection between that question about assessment in schools and the very first questions, because all of this contributes to the mental health problems in our society, because every time you have winners at world best practice level, you have losers. And that's usually the majority of your society. And then you wonder why you have a massive problem with suicide and why people don't cope with modern society. It's because it's obsessed with competition. And it's appalling, the personal effects that it has. On terms of funding for schools, the Greens' commitment is to needs-based funding for schools. The policy is in part a reaction against the excessive amounts that were made to the elite private schools under the Howard government years. And believe me, it's tragic to know the difference between the facilities at the elite boys' schools of Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and your average state school. And so we have a commitment. It doesn't matter what denomination or whether it's private or public, the commitment is to needs-based funding for the education system.
Brett Mason.
I would be reluctant to adopt your view on competition. I think competition has its place in every facet of society. It's how, so long as it's cooperative. No, not say for six-year-olds, but NAPLAN, for example, the testing. I agree with NAPLAN. It's the national testing that across Australia. It might be too much, and there's an argument whether there's too much of it, but do I think there should be national testing to determine how kids are progressing? Yes, I do. In terms of funding... I went to a Catholic primary school and then government schools my entire education. Increasingly, however, people are choosing to go to independent Catholic schools as opposed to state schools. That's their choice. And the coalition has said no school will be worse off.
Wendy?
Family First supports choice in education across the board. The problem I would have with the national curriculum is, are there going to be things that the national curriculum says that church schools, for instance, would have to teach that they would prefer not to teach, or if the sex education comes in, would that have to be taught? Is our children not going to be able to, our parents not going to have the right to be able to keep their children out of some things? That's the concerns I would have the national curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Look, I've got a mental health question, and then we might have one more on human rights, and then invite you to wrap up. The mental health one is perhaps quite specific, but it is in relation to a Vietnam veteran who has ongoing support for PTSD, and they ask if an ongoing support program, why is an annual referral required from a GP to maintain coverage or continue with a multi-year mental health support program? Now, Claire, do you want to...
In other forms of our payments, we're moving away from in terms of working with people who are ill, we're moving away from annual referrals. Within the particular area of PTSD at this stage in DVA, they're saying that it's a very important link between the ongoing health of the veteran, which is not just mental health, the ongoing health of the veteran linking into their mental health, because one of the things they have established through the DVA process is that often people have a range of issues that all combine. So it's very rarely just the mental health aspects of the PTSD that need to be considered. So that at the moment is the linkage that there needs to be, and an understanding that the veteran should have the right, and does, to have that general checkup with their GP, part of which is their annual referral for their ongoing mental health support.
That's great. That's a good practical answer. I'm going to just have one more question here, which was one the panel didn't get to. Libby, did you want to? You didn't need to respond to that. Yeah, okay. This is about human rights abuses. It actually picks up the war in Afghanistan, which is something we haven't even really talked about. So let's pick it up in the last few minutes of tonight because it's a key issue. And this question is that much has been said in public discussion about asylum seekers in recent years and the role of people smugglers, and yet they are exploiting the desperation of people who are fleeing persecution from human rights abuses and dangerous situations, often at the hands of their own government. And so part of the solution must be the way in which Australia seeks to uphold and enforce human rights situations in countries, in source countries, where those rights are being abused. Would you make a comment, firstly, about the role Australia needs to play in places where there are severe conflict and persecution leading to the flight of people as refugees? And secondly, is the presence of forces in Afghanistan designed to decrease the human rights abuses which lead to people fleeing? And if so, then what is happening in terms of the number of people who are continuing to flee from that country? So a couple of issues there, but I'd invite your responses. Wendy, how about we start with you, and we'll just move through the panel.
So the overall goal in Afghanistan has to be to build an independent and a democratic and stable Afghanistan. It's interesting when you talk to the soldiers themselves or even the families of the soldiers that they are totally committed to what their children are doing over there, and they believe in it. So that helps me believe in it because they do. But our goal is to build a stable Afghanistan so that people don't have to flee there to come here.
I think that's right, Wendy. And also, I think the initial motivation when the troops were initially sent there was to prevent Afghanistan becoming a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. That was the initial motivation. And the secondary motivation, of course, was to establish a democratic country because generally, not always, but generally, they are more stable countries. And in terms of peacekeeping and so forth, I know that's controversial because, you know, we've lost quite a few soldiers now in Afghanistan. Is it worth the price? Well, I think so far, sir, yes. And we may disagree, and that's fine. But I do. I think our intervention in recent years in the Solomons and it's Timor, again, were appropriate. And I know John Howard was scared to hell that we would lose troops in East Timor. We didn't. I know we didn't. But we very easily could have. And who here would stand up and say we shouldn't have sent troops to East Timor?
Libby.
I'm sure there are some idealistic Australian troops in Afghanistan. And while the official reason, you know, was to stop terrorism, we never had time to have a public debate about what is the best way to stop terrorism. Instead, we had the federal government rushing to support the American and NATO intervention. And, of course, Bob Brown repeatedly tried to get the Australian commitment to Iraq and Afghanistan debated in Parliament, but the government, John Howard, flatly refused to even have a parliamentary debate about the commitment of those forces. And I think that's a tragedy for Australians and for our democracy. Obviously, the best way to stop terrorism is to build a world based on greater international security. And the Greens, of course, have a commitment to working towards greater disarmament. And, of course, again, we do have good examples, the Australian commitment to the Solomon Islands. There have indeed been good peacekeeping initiatives that Australia has supported that show the way that we could pursue. You know, the Solomons just had so many foreign weaponry imported into that country and, you know, it's the big questions that neither major parties seem to want to take on because they don't want to look idealistic because everybody's so cynical and everybody's appealing to the lowest common denominator. But there's actually a really strong international record on the kind of things you could do to build a more secure world, and that's what we have to do. And we have to do it even if you don't want to be decent about it. The fact is that governments love, you know, they love, prime ministers love saluting the troops, but they really hate paying for veterans. And that was all I was going to add to that question about the Vietnam veteran. We're still paying for that war. We're still paying for World War II.
But governments never want to admit how much gets spent on taking care of the veterans long term. The veterans budget is usually hidden amidst lots of other figures because the veteran organisations are always asking about it. And I can tell you that the oral history work that I've done talking to the wives of veterans is the constant battle, no matter which war you talk about, the constant battle the families always have trying to get decent treatment post-events. And that's the kind of debate we needed to have before we committed to Afghanistan. There are genuinely important issues in Afghanistan. I don't think we should just exit without a strategy. We need to, that's the responsibility of the Australian government, is to start having serious talks with NATO and the US so that the civilians aren't harmed, particularly the women and girls, for whom when the Western forces withdraw, who knows what will end up in Afghanistan. So we need to start being... I think the original commitment was wrong, but we are there, and we now have to be responsible about how we exit that country.
Thanks, Libby. And Claire, you've got your own microphone there. That's okay.
I always find these questions particularly difficult, David, because I am a pacifist, and I've made that statement in Parliament, so it makes it difficult to talk on issues of war. But in terms of your question, which was about human rights, we absolutely have a responsibility in terms of looking at human rights issues in other countries. It's very difficult as a single government, and I think Libby's points about an international responsibility are true. By the way, we did have a debate in Parliament about the Iraq War, and it was quite an extensive debate. But in terms of... No, it was before the commitment, and in terms of process, it, unfortunately, the Senate actually voted against the Iraq War, but the troops are already on their way, but we hadn't already committed as a government. But it just so it happens. In terms of process, I think we must speak out about human rights. We have a history of doing that. There are ways of doing it, though, in terms of how powerful you can be as a single government talking to another government about human rights issues in their country. And we have had recent experiences where it has been very difficult. And when you look at the issues around Sri Lanka and also around things that are happening in the Israel-Palestinian situation, individual governments have spoken, and we as a nation have actually spoken to the governments involved in those areas. But whether that has the appropriate impact, I don't believe it does. I think we need to have a wider international response again, so that it's more voices speaking out about which those things that we see are abuses of human rights. That is the case in Afghanistan, and our commitment in Afghanistan is actually part of not just a personal commitment from our country, it's an international commitment there. So we are not making decisions alone on our role in Afghanistan. It's also part about the general approach in that country. But I think that there needs to be very careful scrutiny about what's happening in that country, and the role of the current government needs to be under examination, so it's not seen that our particular military support, which is clearly to ensure that people are safe and that the incursions by the Taliban are not stronger, if we are not seeing an effective, democratic and sensitive government in place, what are we supporting? So in terms of our ongoing process, it's making sure that those questions continue to be asked.
Thank you very much. That is the end of the questions, and I'm going to invite you to express appreciation to Claire Moore, Libby Connors, Brett Mason and Wendy Francis. As always in these things, there are more questions left than answers. There are things that haven't been addressed. There are issues we've just glossed over and things that we haven't even acknowledged. But we hope that this has been informative and stimulating in terms of your own thinking about the issues and hearing what the different parties think and what their policy directions are. As we close, I'm going to ask the Anglican Dean, Peter Catt, to close in prayer for us.
Blessed are you, Lord God of all creation. You lavish the gift of life upon us. We give you thanks for the fragile creature we call democracy. We pray for all who take part in this election, for the people of this nation, for the candidates, their advisers, the members of the media. May all be blessed with the gifts of integrity and discernment, wisdom, clarity of thought, and dedication. We offer you this prayer through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Thank you.
you part two. If you're interested, it's St Paul's Uniting Church, Stafford on Webster Road at 6:30 for 7 o'clock, same time next Monday night, the 9th of August. Hope we'll see some of you there again, and we'll look forward to seeing at least a couple of our people from the panel there tonight there again. Thank you again for coming. Good night.